No doubt you've heard that phrase, billions of billions, referring to the number of stars out there. Well, there actually, as it turns out, more like 2 trillion galaxies, each with about 100 billion stars in it. And it turns out that those galaxies and a lot of other visible things out there are less than 5% of the universe. The rest of it is what we call the dark side of the universe. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. Well, what's that other 95% of the universe that we can't see? We're going to get some ideas from my guest, Eric Wilcotts, professor of astronomy at the UW-Madison and the deputy dean of the College of Letters and Sciences. Welcome to University of the Air.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Right away, we have this problem with things we can't see. I'm reminded of a form of chess where neither of the two opponents can see the other's men, but you know something is happening because your queen just disappeared. You know, is that what it's like, discovering, finding dark matter?
That is actually a pretty good analogy, right? So what we now understand, and it took a long time to understand this, is mass, the stuff that you and I are made out of, makes space curve. This is something Einstein taught us. We could talk about this a bit more. But mass has this ability to make things move around it, right? And so you think about the Earth going around the sun. Well, why does the Earth go around the sun? Because the sun has mass and that gravitational tug that the sun exerts on the Earth. And the Earth exerts a little gravitational tug on the sun. That makes the Earth go around the sun. It actually makes the Earth and the sun both move a little, and the sun just doesn't move as much as the Earth does. But if you look out into space and you see things moving, and you can measure how fast they're moving, and you see, gee, what are they moving around? And you don't see what they're moving around or their velocity, the speed at which they're moving, implies more mass than you see. You can reach a conclusion there must be some other stuff out there that has mass that we can't see. And we call it dark matter.
It must be pretty complicated, though, because you have so many things that you can see that would affect the movement of any given body out there.
Yes. So the one of the early experiments, if you will, done this was by looking at stars in our own galaxy. And so astronomers in the middle of the 1900s discovered that stars in our own galaxy seemed to be moving faster than they should be. And they said, well, why? How can they be moving so fast? Well, there must be some other mass around that could account for that. And this was extended to other galaxies, looking at how galaxies spin. We can measure that rotational velocity, what we call it, how fast that galaxy is spinning. We can sort of see how big the galaxy is. And so if I have a velocity and if I have a size, I can calculate a mass. And then I can look at how much starlight I see and I can say, well, I can make some assumptions about how many stars that is and how massive that is. And I say, well, I'm missing something. I can only account for maybe 10%. Of the mass that must be in that galaxy to account for the fact that the galaxy is spinning at the velocity at which I measure it. And so that really cemented the idea of dark matter. The galaxies were really spinning too fast based on how much starlight we saw.
Yeah, so where do you go from there? There's nothing to see.
You try to figure out what it is. And this has been a long, and we don't know yet. Mm-hmm. And what I tell my students and others, that if you want a free trip to Sweden and meet the king, you can discover what dark matter is. And I can guarantee you will get that trip to Sweden to discover this. So we astronomers and physicists have played around with all sorts of ideas, exotic, different types of exotic particles. Or maybe it actually is normal stuff, but it's just too faint to see. Those models just don't work. And so now I think people are looking in sort of the particle physics regime, tiny particles, lots of them, widely distributed. This must be what the dark matter is made out of. And we have folks at UW-Madison who actually are conducting experiments that try to see the very rare, the results of the very rare interaction between dark matter and other normal matter. And if you sort of look downstream of that interaction, you might be able to detect something.
So dark matter, if you can't see it, then that means it probably certainly doesn't emit light and it certainly doesn't reflect light.
Correct.
Probably
it doesn't absorb light either.
Doesn't absorb light either.
It doesn't interact with light.
So it doesn't do you any good to bounce light off of this.
Correct.
Because you won't get
Correct.
Any reaction.
Correct. You hope for some odd interaction between a dark matter particle and some other particle interact in some way that generates some energy that then leads to a detection that you can make down the road. And that's really what the dark matter experiments are really aimed at trying to do.
Well, let's go back to the beginning, by which I mean the beginning.
The beginning, yes.
What is it, 14 billion years or something like that?
13.7, as best we can tell.
Universe lying about its age again. But the Big Bang,
yes.
Is that still a concept, a valid concept?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that I mean, there's a remarkable history of that discovery of understanding the Big Bang. But we now understand the universe as having began in some primeval fireball, rapid expansion. And we are still living with that expansion. So the universe itself is still getting larger.
So a couple of things. This fireball started out, was it very, very, very small and very, very, very dense?
Yes, and very, very, very hot.
It had, did it have in it all of the matter that's currently in the universe?
Yes.
Because matter cannot be, I mean.
Correct.
Yeah,
yeah. So
there.
It's a balance between energy and matter. And so over time, that some of that energy, and thanks to Einstein again, we have E equals MC squared. So you can go back and forth between energy and matter, energy and mass.
It's got to be one or the other, though.
Yeah, it's got to be one or the other, and you can't create one.
Just you can't destroy it.
Right, and so the Big Bang contained all of the energy, all of the stuff that we now have in the universe was in the Big Bang, and that's actually how the original concept came about. Once astronomers discovered that the universe appeared to be expanding, and that was an observational result, you can then do the thought experiment. We'll say, okay, if it's expanding, if I run that clock backwards, it must have been smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. And you get back to this thing that became known as the Big Bang. And then you say, well, I've got all this mass in the universe, all this energy, and I'm crunching all that down into this tiny, tiny, tiny volume. Well, what does that mean? What does that imply? And that gives you a sense of kind of energies. And then you can go ahead, well, if that really were the case, I should expect to see X, Y, and Z. And over the years, we've seen X, Y, and Z.
Well, so a couple of questions. One being, what would make it blow up in the first place?
Good question.
Next question.
next question. We honestly do not have an answer for that. There are physical theories about vacuum energies and things like this, but we don't really have a good explanation for how it gets started in the first place.
All right. Next question. Once we have the Big Bang, this matter expanding rapidly takes various forms. I mean, well, I guess what in the first, what, nanosecond or something, most of the or all of the natural elements are formed?
Not all of them. The Big Bang, this is actually one of the really, really neat things. The Big Bang, what we call Big Bang nucleosynthesis, big word, right? Just means making elements. We start with hydrogen. We can get helium, maybe a little bit of lithium, maybe. But by the time the universe has done that, is it expanded so much and cooled so much that it can't make anything else. So the original stuff in the universe is hydrogen and helium.
And it gradually takes various forms, I mean, elements notwithstanding. I heard somewhere that it is only thanks to the, we'll call them, flaws in this Big Bang that we owe the current variety of matter in the universe?
I don't know so much of it's flaws.
It's a value judgment.
There's an imbalance between what we call matter and antimatter in the universe, and there's more matter than antimatter. And so that allows us to exist. Design, whatever, not a flaw. Right, and then the variety of stuff that we've got, the variety of matter in the universe, is just a ramification of that. And the ramification of starting with this Big Bang of lots of particles, and then as the universe expands, other things happen on the local level that alter the nature of those particles. We make stars, for example. That does different things. That creates a different set of particles. And so the universe itself has been acting on the matter within it in a variety of ways to give us this wide array of particles, this wide array of elements, that and right away to structures that we now see.
Including all the dark matter, which we think might be particles?
We think might be particles.
And
best guess. Yes.
For whatever reason, they have different properties from these other
particles.
They just
don't interact with radiation in terms of they don't interact with light. So all the there's some really wonderful simulations of the large scale structure of the universe. And they start with a soup of dark matter and normal matter. And over time, what we see is that the normal matter knows where the dark matter is and concentrates there. But it's more concentrated than the dark matter. So you can think of the Milky Way, our home galaxy. You go out at night and you see the beautiful Milky Way. We are somewhat embedded in a larger halo of dark matter. And so the normal stuff, as I say, concentrates in these halos of dark matter. And so that's how it interacts with things that we know. But there's probably dark matter all around us, not to scare the listeners, but there is probably dark matter in the solar system. It's just not very important on the scales of the solar system.
Not very important, except maybe collectively, if you have a lot of it.
If you have a lot of it on large enough scales, dark matter begins to dominate. But if you look at our own solar system and say, what determines how the Earth moves, how the moon moves, how the asteroids move, you can do all that without dark matter.
And is dark matter something like, what, neutrinos that you can actually track if you have the right kind of soup?
We thought they were neutrinos for a long time, but neutrinos interact with light, so they're not neutrinos. But that's the idea, that it is a particle that is very pervasive, right? And we are moving through it if you want to think about it that way.
Now, you mentioned antimatter, which is, of course, a wonderful term that conjures all kinds of science fiction episodes. And what's the difference between matter and antimatter?
It's sort of like every particle has an evil twin. And when they meet, basically they combine and turn into energy. And so it's a positively charged electron. Electron's a negatively charged particle. There's a positively charged mirror image of that. That if you collide those two things, you'll get some energy out of it. Right. And so that's the antimatter.
Does this happen often around here?
Not around these parts, no. But early in the universe, there probably was a period in that first nanoseconds of this back and forth, matter and antimatter, turning into energy and then coming back into matter and going back and forth until the universe expanded enough that you shut off that reaction. So you can think of the early universe as a rapid expansion. Things are getting bigger. Things are cooling down. And there's a series of reactions between particles that require a certain amount of matter and a certain temperature. And as long as the universe is hot enough and dense enough, those reactions will take place. The universe expands. You shut off that reaction. You're stuck with what you have left at the end.
And the universe is not only expanding. Did Einstein think it was actually static? I read that somewhere. It's hard to believe.
He really wanted it to be static. In the sense that and you go back in time and put yourself in the early 1900s, right? Nothing you could imagine suggests that the universe is changing its size, right? You look up at the stars move, but nothing, there's nothing in you can think about that would imply the universe is changing on those scales. But if you go through the equations of general relativity, they lead you to a conclusion that the universe is changing in size. And Einstein was uncomfortable with this notion, and so he stuck in what became known as a cosmological constant. It was a way to keep the universe static, basically because that's what he understood. That's what he deeply, deeply thought the universe had to be. It had to be static. That was wrong, and he admitted later on it was wrong. And so that was the origin of this thing called a cosmological constant.
So the universe is expanding. We know that.
Yep.
And it's expanding more rapidly every day.
So now you're getting into dark energy. So as I say, starting in sort of the mid-1900s, we had this notion of dark matter, really cemented that. So the 1970 or so, Vera Rubin, an unheralded astronomer, was really the one who discovered this rotation of galaxies and really made the convincing argument that there's dark matter. So astronomers were very comfortable with this notion of dark matter, making up 90% of the universe. But then in measuring the distances to some very distant galaxies and measuring their velocities, discovered this sort of perturbing, disturbing trend that they seem to be moving faster than they should based on our understanding of the expansion of the universe. And the only, after going through those numbers, the conclusion that was reached is that the expansion rate must be accelerating. So that the universe not only is expanding, but that rate of expansion is getting faster.
How does that work within the laws of physics?
That's a really, really good question. So your second trip to Sweden to meet the king is to discover what dark energy is. So the dark energy, it was coined to explain what could be driving an expansion or an acceleration of that rate of expansion. Some energy we don't know. It behaves sort of like a negative pressure, but that doesn't really make a lot of physical sense. And so this is really an open question. What is driving that acceleration? And again, this is an area of astronomy and physics we don't really know. Actively being researched to try to figure out at least how to characterize it, at least mathematically how to characterize it. That doesn't really tell you what it is, but at least gives you an equation you can write down that says, all right, this is what dark energy must look like mathematically.
This is the effect
it
has.
So we're trying to do that. Mm-hmm. But to really understand what it is, we're not there yet.
So not only things are moving farther away from each other in the universe in all directions, but more quickly all the time.
Yes.
Do we have any sense that it's there used to be a theory. There used to be a theory that the whole thing would then come to a certain point and then collapse on itself.
Yep. It appears that the universe is really finely tuned in the sense of the expansion, although the acceleration may be changing this, but the expansion is just enough that at some point it will just sort of gradually slow down, never quite contract, but just kind of approach as a point of being static.
So back pretty close to Einstein's idea.
Pretty close to Einstein. But we don't. I mean, that's based on whatever census we can make of what's in the universe. So most people, when they're thinking about cosmology now, think that the universe is what we call at the so-called critical density to reach this ultimate state. It's not there yet, but maybe it will be. But there could be things that we don't know. I'm sure there are things that we don't know. That could alter that.
How about a second grader's question? What keeps it going then?
That's a good question. Before dark energy, it was essentially, we had an expansion and it's just slowing down, and the mass in the universe is slowing down that expansion, so it will slow down over time, and that made sense. It's just sort of the initial momentum.
Yes.
Right. With dark energy, there's something that is acting to really to keep it moving, and that's what we don't know what that is.
So, what do you look for?
I stay a little closer to home. in the sense that I have spent most of my career thinking about galaxies like the Milky Way and why do they look the way they do. I oversimplify things a bit, if I may, to think of a galaxy like the Milky Way is basically a machine that turns gas into stars. And what I want to know is, how did it get its gas? What are the processes that affect that flow of gas in and out of the galaxy? And how does the environment impact the process of turning that gas into stars?
Well, let's look at the Milky Way galaxy then when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with astronomer Eric Wilcotts. We have looked at some of the dark side of the universe, dark matter and dark energy. And now we're going to look closer to home, although I think probably we will not abandon those two things entirely, as they seem to be all around us. But if we look at our own galaxy, the Milky Way, 100 billion stars, maybe something like that.
Yep. Uh-huh.
So as Carl Sagan would say, billions, but he'd have to say a lot more times.
Mm-hmm.
And estimate on how many planets, habitable or otherwise, buzzing around those stars?
Oh, my goodness. I think it's a rough estimate if you look up in the night sky and you see all of the stars up there, that the vast majority of them have planets orbiting them. Many of them might have 3 or 4 or 5 planets orbiting them. And so you just do the math on maybe half the stars in the galaxy have planets, right? So that's still a lot of planets.
Why would a galaxy form in the first place? I mean, there are various forms of galaxies.
Yes.
Well, ours is a spiral.
Ours is a spiral.
Is that the most common?
That's a good question. It's not the most common, and it varies with environment. There's a real – in terms of galaxies are sometimes I describe them as being somewhat social creatures, in that you typically find galaxies amongst other galaxies.
Clusters of galaxies.
Clusters of galaxies are at the sort of the extreme end of that, where you've got thousands of galaxies very close together in terms of astronomical scales. Right? So the way to think about it is that on average – a galaxy in a cluster will have another galaxy that might be 2 or 3 galaxy diameters away. And so you can sort of think about this, the difference between living in Manhattan and living in rural Wisconsin, right? In Manhattan, you can walk down the street and the next person is sort of right next to you, each other. That's a cluster. You get out into rural Wisconsin where the next person might be 30, 40 steps away. Then you're in sort of what we call the field, as it were. And that's the environment where we typically find spiral galaxies. In clusters, we typically find elliptical galaxies that have had different star formation histories.
And are there some global ones also?
There are globular ones that are sort of roundish. And then there are, because astronomers back in the early 1900s when we discovered galaxies, said, there's spiral things. there's elliptical things. And then there are some other things. And we said, those are irregulars. Because, you couldn't fit them in one bin or another. But that distinction arose in the early 1900s as astronomers recognized that what was then known as the spiral nebulae were actually separate galaxies, like the Milky Way, just really far away.
And they have – galaxies seem to have different planes.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, so if you imagine one that's, from our standpoint, horizontal, there could be another one that's cocked at 30 or even 90 degrees.
Absolutely, right. The inclination as we see it can vary. So a galaxy like the Milky Way, as you say, is a disk, and people can think about an old-fashioned vinyl record. They still have those things. Right. So a flat disk that's much the diameter is much larger than the thickness, right? And that's spinning, and it's rotating, right? And this is what we talked about in the previous section, that rotation tells us, boy, this thing is sitting in a bunch of dark matter.
Right.
So we're sitting maybe a third or a halfway out from the center of the Milky Way galaxy, just happily going around in the orbit. The sun is orbiting about the center of the galaxy. And it takes about 250 million years to take one trip around the center of the galaxy.
A galactic year.
Yeah, that is roughly a galactic year, yes.
Why do these galaxies form in the first place then? Why are these spiral, fairly tidy, consistently formed sets of 100 billion stars
right. So there is a range of masses of galaxies. So there's your regulars tend to be smaller. Some of the ellipticals are actually very, very large. We think that if you go back in time to the shortly after the Big Bang, the universe is not perfectly smooth.
Right. That's the fault earlier.
The imperfections.
Yeah.
So they're little bits of regions where it's a little denser than other regions. And those become sort of the seeds around which first the dark matter gathers, the dark matter sort of piles up there, and then the normal matter follows that. And so those imperfections are what lead to galaxies. And so we look back in time, you can sort of see how people are trying to figure out how galaxies form. But is that process of normal matter coming into one of these dark matter, we call dark matter halo, and the process by which that gas accumulates to make stars. If it's a fairly rapid process, you might just get something that looks very spherical. If the gas sort of flows in and one big whoomph, and you end up with a sort of roundish thing. If it's a more of a gradual process comes in, angular momentum tells us that we'll get this rotating disk. And then the spiral arms can develop within that rotating disk.
And you need dark matter then to form a galaxy?
You need every galaxy we know has dark matter around it. Yes.
So it's one of the key ingredients.
It's a key. I gave a talk years and years ago at a science festival in South Africa. I said, all right, if you want to do this at home, which I don't recommend, right? You get 10 parts of dark matter into your bowl, sort of one part normal matter into your bowl, and you sort of swirl it around, and you end up with a nice galaxy there in the middle of your bowl. But you do need that dark matter to do it. There are people that spend a lot of time trying to find galaxies that are either pure dark matter, which really wouldn't be a galaxy, just sort of be a blob of dark matter, or galaxies that don't have dark matter, and we haven't found either.
These galaxies will also sometimes collide, won't they?
Yes, in spectacular fashion. So the thing to remember about when a galaxy collides, so our nearest large galaxies, Andromeda, called M31, it's very far away, but we are approaching it. And at some point in the future, we will collide. So what does that mean? Galaxy is actually mostly empty. So when a galaxy collides, it's not that a star in the Milky Way is going to collide with a star in Andromeda. What's more likely is that the gas clouds in the Milky Way, being very large and filling up a lot of the volume, will collide with gas clouds in Andromeda. And that collision of the gas clouds probably leads to more star formation. So we end up making more stars. The other thing that happens is that, going back to gravity, you have these two massive things that are approaching one another. They really want to tear each other apart. The tidal forces will just really mess up the structure. But in the end, they'll collide and everybody will come back together, probably in an elliptical galaxy. So the ultimate fate of the Milky Way and Andromeda is probably a very large elliptical galaxy.
These galaxies, as they continue to expand away from, we get into trouble here, the center of the universe. Whatever and wherever that is. unlike the galaxies themselves, which have this spin to them around a center, and certainly unlike the planets that have a spin around a central star, a sun, the galaxies seem to be just kind of every which way. I mean, they don't seem to be actually going around a center of any kind.
Correct. So there is no center of the universe. Right? And so this is where we have a lot of fun. Right? So first of all, the expansion, there are a number of analogies that people do to try to get a visual of what the expansion looks like. And so one of the ones that we try to do, say, in introductory astronomy class is if you have a balloon, and you put small peppercorns on the balloon, and then you blow up the balloon. Every peppercorn on that balloon will look out and see all these other peppercorns moving away from it. And I'll say, wow, everybody's moving away from me. But every peppercorn sees the same thing. Why? Because the balloon itself is expanding and the peppercorns are along for the ride.
Right.
The galaxies are along for the ride as the universe expands. Now, the difference is, when you think back to that balloon analogy, and it's not quite right with peppercorns, because what I want you to think about is just the surface of that balloon. We want to think of ourselves in this analogy as perfectly two-dimensional creatures. And we're living on the surface of this balloon. And all we know is that our universe is getting bigger. We go in that direction, it's getting bigger. We look in that, the other direction, it's getting bigger. Right? But if you think about that surface, just think about the surface of the balloon. There is no center to the surface of the balloon.
Right. Okay.
Right. So we are living in this three-dimensional universe that is expanding. Okay. It probably means that there's probably a fourth dimension, right, that we have to wrestle with. And our brains don't wrestle well with more dimensions than we're used to. Right. So there's no center of the universe that as we know it. But if we're going to push this analogy, maybe in an additional dimension, Who knows? Maybe there is some center, but we're not there. We can't visualize it. We can't get to it. The universe isn't rotating around it.
You want to talk about the role of time in all of this?
The role of time. Time is it's a funny thing, and it's not a spatial dimension. And just as an aside, right? Some of the depictions of time travel. Right. If you think about in Hollywood movies, some of them are better.
What, exceeding
than
the speed of light is that exceeding theoretically the speed of light
and going back in time and things like that. How do you visualize that? The only way you can really visualize that if time becomes a spatial dimension, right? You and I can walk forward and we can walk backwards. Time only goes in one direction. So there is this time is another dimension, but it is not a physical dimension in the sense of saying, boy, it's we have a four dimensional space that we're living in.
And what's the time scale of the universe then? We're talking 13.7 years from the Big Bang.
Yep.
So what happens at various points in the, I'll call it the maturation, if not the aging of the universe?
So the first big events are actually very, very early on. And that's what we talked about a little bit earlier, the creation of hydrogen and helium.
Right.
That happens in the first few hundred years. Right. Then we get through a period of maybe 1,000 years or so. Of just the universe expanding, being very, very, very dense, still very hot. We go through a number of reactions, and the physicists have come to think of the forces of nature. They can mark the clock of the early universe at various points where those forces became distinct, that electromagnetism became distinct from something we call the strong force, which is distinct from something we call the weak force. Those are the forces that work on the atomic scale. Fitting gravity into all this is one of those sort of holy grails of physics.
I was going to ask about gravity.
How do you fit gravity into this? And boy, there's lots of people thinking about that. So we get to this period where the universe is expanding, and then from an astronomical point of view, we're kind of stuck. Because there's a point for what we call the dark ages of the universe where that hydrogen I talked about, the hydrogen is just a proton and an electron.
Right. Simplest thing there is.
Simple thing there is. There, those hydrogen atoms are just hanging out. They're happy. Right. Every proton has its electron. It's happy.
So why should they add protons or electrons?
Right. And what that means is that light, whatever light there is, doesn't get very far. You know, if you were there to shine a flashlight through the universe, it just gets absorbed right away. So none of that light propagates out.
What do you need to propagate light?
We've got to get rid of the density. We've got to lower that density, and we've got to break apart some of those protons and electrons. Right. Now, we can't do that until we have some really good sources of light. So we, some point early in the universe, and this is a debate about when this happens, the very first stars light up.
And are they coalescing out of this
blobs of
matter?
Remember, those imperfections are starting to work, and little stuff's getting a little close together and compressing, and gravity's working, and then something turns on that very first star.
So they're emitting light.
And they start emitting light. And then the universe starts becoming transparent. And so this sort of moment, what we call reionization, is something that astronomers are actively trying to figure out when it started, how long did it take, what were those very first objects. We don't know this. So this is something that's really, really at the forefront of research. What we do know is we have from the this is called microwave background, which is that last moment when the photons could travel freely before the dark ages start. And so we have that microwave background, and that was what was discovered in the 1960s as well. And that came as a prediction. Once you have this Big Bang theory, it says, well, if there's a Big Bang, you can do the math, and you said, boy, the whole sky, wherever I look, I should be able to detect the universe at a certain temperature, 2.7 degrees Kelvin, really cold.
Yes.
And this was discovered in the 1960s. And a Nobel Prize followed that to sort of cement that idea of the Big Bang.
So you have the first stars forming.
Yep.
What about the galaxies?
There actually are ideas that and then we'll get even trickier, that maybe stars weren't the first things that formed. Maybe black holes formed first.
Aha.
Aha. So now we get black holes. If black holes form first, then maybe we have some accretion around the black hole, which generates radiation before stuff falls into the black hole.
Yes, because they do suck in everything.
They suck in everything, and maybe we get some radiation around that, and maybe that's the first thing that reionizes the universe. Now, the interesting thing is when we look at galaxies today, every galaxy has at its center a supermassive black hole.
Yeah, that's what I hear. So, okay, as long as we're getting toward the formation of our own Milky Way galaxy with its own black hole, what keeps the whole galaxy from getting sucked into that black hole?
That's the beauty of both the size of what we're dealing with. Right? The black hole is tiny.
But very, very...
It's massive. It's probably our black hole, maybe 10 million times the mass of the sun.
Very, very, very dense.
Very, 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 very dense, yes. Mm-hmm. And it sits there at the center of the galaxy. And around the black hole, there are actually things moving around that black hole. And one of the great discoveries of the last decade or so, people can actually watch individual stars in their orbits around that black hole. They're moving very fast.
Well, I mean, from what you're telling me, Eric, the everything in the galaxy is to some extent moving around that
everything
black
hole. Everything in the black hole is moving around. Everything in the galaxy is moving around the center. Right. And so what we have is there this black hole sitting there, this galaxy that's around it, and in the Milky case, the Milky Way, orbiting about in circular orbits. Now, as you go out from the black hole, because there are stars, it's more and more mass. And so the sun is sitting here orbiting at about 230 kilometers per second, zipping around the galaxy, 220 or so kilometers per second. And that number comes from the fact that we got a lot of stars between us and the center of the galaxy, and there's a lot of dark matter between us and the center of the galaxy. And that determines that velocity that the sun is moving around.
And that keeps it from going in?
That keeps it from falling in. Oh, yeah. It's angular momentum would be sort of the easiest way to think about it. We're just moving too fast angularly to be falling inwards or zipping outwards.
It's so we can all be glad.
Yeah. Yeah. We're all nicely balanced.
So you mentioned you were interested in how the gas flows into and out of galaxies.
Yes.
And so that implies that there is this kind of dynamic flow back and forth that somehow contributes to the maintenance of the galaxy?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So the question, if you look at galaxies throughout the universe and you look at their stars, and one of the really, really neat things about astronomy is that I can look at what we call the stellar population of a galaxy, and that records the history of star formation in that galaxy. So I can look at parts of the Milky Way, look at parts of Andromeda, parts of other galaxies, and know that, that galaxy formed half of its stars 5 billion years ago. Or that other galaxy formed 10% of its stars 5 billion years ago. Boy, this galaxy over here seemed to form 90% of its stars 10 billion years ago. So that history is recorded in the stars that we see in the galaxy. So when you look at the galaxies, you can say, boy, there's a different star formation history. And remember, you need gas to make stars.
Right.
That tells us that there's something about the gas content of that galaxy that has evolved with time.
So what kind of gas are we talking about, by the way?
Hydrogen gas, molecular gas, carbon monoxide. We start with the simple stuff, and I think a lot about hydrogen. So the hydrogen atom, which is a great, great atom, if you can envision in your mind that proton and that electron, and they are spinning. Tiny little particle spinning. And you can say, well, they're going to either spin in a way that they're both spinning in the same direction, or one is spinning in the opposite direction of the other. The difference between those two states, as a hydrogen atom goes from one to the other, it can send out radiation. And that radiation is at a wavelength, that light that comes from enough hydrogen, is at a wavelength of 21 centimeters.
Eh? That's simple.
That's simple. Mm-hmm. How do I look for that? I need a radio telescope to do that. And so that is why radio telescopes are really, really good at showing us where the hydrogen gas is in galaxies. And if I can digress just for a second, a little Wisconsin lore, if you would, that late 1920s, a fellow by the name of Carl Jansky graduated from UW-Madison. And he took a job at Bell Labs in New Jersey after he graduated and was working on some of their early communications equipment. And realized that there is a source of noise that he was detecting. And he realized that it seemed to be seasonal. and with a little more investigation, realized that the noise that they were detecting in the early communication equipment was coming from the constellation Sagittarius.
Seasonally.
Seasonally. And so it was the discovery of radio astronomy, of using radio equipment to map, to look at the universe. And what we now know is that radio emission that's coming from the constellation Sagittarius is the radio emission associated with all of the activity that's going on in the center of the Milky Way. So Carl Jansky discovered the radio emission from the center of the Milky Way galaxy. And so, as Wisconsin alum. And so now there's actually the unit we use in radio astronomy is a Jansky. And the Very Large Array Radio Telescope in New Mexico is the Carl Jansky Very Large Array, named after him. So the father of radio astronomy was from Madison.
So let's look in a minute at the composition, the full, let's take inventory
yes.
of the Milky Way galaxy mm-hmm. and find out exactly what it's doing when we return in a moment.
Okay.
This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Eric Wilcotts, an astronomer, professor of astronomy at the UW-Madison. We've been looking at dark matter and dark energy, which constitute, as far as we know, about 95% of the universe. And then there's the other 5% or less that we can actually see in some form, including much but not all of our Milky Way galaxy. So we've used this standard figure, I did at the beginning anyway, Eric, of 100 billion stars, roughly, for a kind of a garden variety galaxy. Mm-hmm. Is the Milky Way fairly typical?
Yeah, it's fairly typical. Yep. Run-of-the-mill mm-hmm. sort of average galaxy.
And it has this gas flowing in and out of it, hydrogen, carbon dioxide.
Carbon monoxide, CO.
It is carbon monoxide.
Yep.
Flowing in and out to, in effect, create stars?
It's regulating that star formation. Mm-hmm. Right. So the galaxy is converting gas into stars. And the other neat thing about when stars in their lifetimes, they inject energy back out into the environment, and that energy can push some gas out of the galaxy.
But so it's like it's breathing almost.
It's kind of you could sort of think of it as breathing. But.
It's destroying stars too, is it, along the way?
The stars will go through a lifetime, and they will essentially most of them will destroy themselves. The lower mass stars will essentially live forever. But a star like the Milky Way, like our own sun, we've got another 4.5 billion years, and then the star will start going through end of lifetime. It'll expand, and the outer layers will just sort of gradually drift off into space, into what we call the interstellar medium. We're leaving behind the core of the sun as this really hot sort of ball of carbon that over time will just cool down.
Well, that makes me ask the question, if all the these other components we're talking about of the universe are so stable, seem to have, thanks to dark matter, dark energy, they're almost like a perpetual motion machine. Why do stars die?
Stars have fuel. And again, one of the great discoveries in the 1900s was, if you think about why does the sun shine? What causes that sun to shine? In the core of the sun is something called fusion. The sun is essentially converting hydrogen into helium and in the process releasing energy. And a star can do this. The more massive the star is, it can turn helium into carbon. It can combine carbon into magnesium. It can throw another helium on carbon and get oxygen. It can throw another helium on oxygen and move up to neon and so forth. And this process will work, creating energy, keeping the star going, until you reach the point where it requires energy to do anything else. So once I have an iron core, the star says, oh, I'll try to add something to that iron core. And that leads to a disaster for the star. In other words, it takes sucks energy out of the star to try to make something happen. And the result of that is this sort of the star sort of collapse, and then it rebounds and explodes. So that's the most massive stars will just explode into a supernova. Now, why do we care about supernovae? Like these, other than they're spectacular things in the sky, they're great. Most of the heavy elements, gold, plutonium, uranium,
platinum,
those things were all made in that supernova explosion. So the heaviest elements come out of the explosions of massive stars.
And so what that says is that the Earth, at least in part, is a product of a supernova sometime.
Absolutely.
Maybe more than one?
Maybe more than one, right. And Carl Sagan once said, we are all star stuff. Because all the oxygen in our bodies, all the carbon, all the magnesium, all the iron, that nice vitamin you took this morning that has all that good stuff in it, those elements were made in a star.
What then keeps that galaxy going? It's the dark matter and the dark energy?
Well, if it keeps it going is a supply of gas. So as long as there's some fuel, you can make some stars.
And it has to be then somehow close enough to a source of gas in order to replenish.
Correct. And so we think that around a galaxy like the Milky Way, there's gas around us, just outside of the galaxy, kind of in the suburbs of the galaxy, if you will. And that gas, for reasons we not quite understand, can flow into the galaxy. Right. And where my work comes in is thinking about, oh, gee, how does that happen? Can we see that happening? But if I stick that galaxy in a different environment, what happens if I strip away that
gas?
If you're starving it, then the galaxy is left without a new supply of gas. It will use up what it has. It will make stars. And all of a sudden, it will run out of gas out of which to make new stars. And so now we just have a galaxy that's stuck. It's made all the stars it's going to make. The stars will do their thing. Some of them will explode. Some of them will just get very cold. And it turns off. It becomes very quiet in that sense. And so that's the kind of work that I think about is what are the environmental processes that might make that process happen as galaxies enter into different groups or clusters.
So for the Milky Way, how's our gas supply?
It's pretty good. I think we're good for another 4.5 billion years. No, I think the Milky Way is sitting in what we call the local group. And there seems to be a lot of gas around us. And so I think the Milky Way's got a good long run left in it.
What's your next discovery?
Oh, boy, I wish I knew. So I think if you think about, you know, one of the things, and we haven't talked a little about this very much, is this notion of planets around in the galaxy.
And sure.
This is a real exciting area of astronomy now, is understanding, boy, what are the nature of these other planets around other stars? What do they look like? How do they form? What does it teach us about how our own solar system formed? And so this is something that I'm just inherently curious about, and I tell my students that one day I've spent my career doing galaxies, but I'm going to write a paper on planets one of these days because it really is a fascinating field.
From the street here, it seems to me that's a relatively simple thing compared to all these other galactic, intergalactic forces and gas flow back and forth. I mean, isn't planet really just a kind of a spin-off from a star?
Yeah, it's a disk. We think we formed in a disk around what became the sun. And we're understanding star formation better and better. And there's new telescopes that are helping us with this. But what I think we're also understanding is that the beginning of the solar system is a really violent, violent past. The collisions all the time. And so some of these collisions do really crazy things, like lead to the formation of our moon.
Right.
But we're understanding the early history of planetary systems is something that we're just sort of trying to get to. And there's new radio telescopes coming online that will help us understand what the early history of planetary systems looks like. And that's something to look forward to in the next decade or so.
Well, we have a little bit of, I guess, variety if we just look at our own solar system. If we look at our own solar system, we have a variety of outcomes.
Yes, yes.
You have the, I'll call them the earthy or rocky planets, what, through Mars?
Yep.
Yes. And then the gaseous ones, why the difference? Is that distance really, from the sun?
That's a really good question. We thought we understood that. we thought we knew that, this is the way you make a planetary system. You have a system because the temperature is warmer closer to the star than it is farther away.
Yeah.
And so ask yourself, well, when it's warm, what is the stuff that can turn into a solid when the temperature is, say, 1,000 degrees? Oh, well, that's got to be iron and things like that.
Right.
So that explains why you have the rocky planets close to the star, because the conditions when the solar system formed were too warm to allow the ices to form. And so the only things that could come up solids were the minerals and the iron oxide, things like that, that we see Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars. It all made sense. The outer part of the solar system, things are cooler. So you can make solids out of ices. So ice can form. So you can get water ice, methane ice, things like that. And you can build up these sort of icy things. And then because they get so massive, they just keep all the gas around them, right? And so, and that made a lot of sense until we discovered other planetary systems that seem to have these really big gaseous things really close to their star.
Oh, really?
And so now we have to bring in things like, boy, planets must be moving around when they may form in one place but then migrate to another. And so we are still trying to wrestle with this whole formation process. But I think the basic model that we have is probably about right, but there's some subtleties that all this discovery of other planets has really opened our eyes to the complexities that are out there.
And the bottom line for the layman seems to be that much of science is a matter of unlearning.
It is unlearning. And astronomy works in a way of you start with what you think is and you admit is a relatively simple explanation of some phenomena. You see something. You say, all right, well, if I just go back to sort of the basics, can I explain it? And you start with a relatively simple model. And then over time, as your observations get better and better, you begin to sort of untangle the complexities and the subtleties and really get down to what's going on. And that's the fun of doing what we get to do, is really trying to dive deeper to understand all of the, as I say, the complexities of what the universe throws at us.
Eric Wilcutts, a pleasure.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
It's a kind of a paradox, but looking at dark matter, dark energy, and our Milky Way galaxy with you. We'll look forward to your next visit to University of the Air.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you'll join me for the next University of the Air on Wisconsin Public Radio.